You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 80, Do Babies Understand Math?
Today we're talking to Dr. Rebecca Merkley, who was just hired as a faculty member in Carleton's Department of Cognitive Science, which is my department. Her office is two doors down from mine. Her specialty is math cognition, and in particular, relating the findings of cognitive science to early childhood education. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
So why don't you tell us why math is such an interesting cognitive science problem?
So math is interesting because it's this remarkable human invention, but it has to be culturally transmitted. And so, for example, symbolic numbers, like the digits we use, the numerals, they're too recent of a cultural invention in the history of human evolution to have dedicated brain regions to support their processing. So we learn math through experience, and this experience changes both the way we think about quantity in the world and also changes the brain circuits involved in processing number. And so I'm really interested in this experience-dependent brain development, and particularly the roles of early experience. And how this early experience with number symbols influences this development. And then from a more applied perspective, we know that learning the meaning of numbers is a really important foundational skill for mathematical thinking. And math learning is cumulative, so that earlier skills predict the acquisition of later ones, or in other words, the later learned skills like more advanced geometry and algebra build onto the earlier ones. And actually, research has shown that the math abilities measured at the start of school, so in kindergarten, predict achievement in math long-term.
It seems like children have some kind of innate sense of amount. Like if you give two kids unequal amount of cookies, they know it.
Yeah, they absolutely do. A sense of amount and a sense of fairness, I think, are pretty early developing. But yes, babies are born with some intuitive math abilities, and in particular, understanding quantity. And so when you say amounts, it might not even be sort of the numerical amount, but if I have four cookies and you have two, the four cookies take up more space on my plate too. So that's just, it's obviously more. And so by about 6 months old, babies can notice the difference between these kinds of high ratio differences. So again, like four compared to eight, for example, or doubling, babies seem to notice that difference, but they can't discriminate more exact quantities. So say you had three cookies and I had two, a young kid might not tell the difference between that. And actually, there is some neat research showing that kids' number knowledge relates to their sharing abilities. So kids who haven't yet learned how to use counting to produce exact sets might say they want to share equally with a friend, but don't have the numerical knowledge to be able to make equal sets of, say, cookies or candy.
Oh, so, okay, so they can't perform to the level of fairness that they aspire to?
Exactly, yeah. So one of the studies, the title something about like moral hypocrisy, right? Kids will say, well, we should share them equally, but then they don't have the tools to actually divide up equally.
Yeah, I've always thought kids were hypocrites. Now there's scientific evidence of it.
Well, sometimes it's interpreted as selfishness, right? And so it's like, are they being selfish or do they just not understand how to make an equal set?
All right, so why don't you talk to me, Bill, about one of your passions, how young children begin to learn math.
Yeah, so like I said, my focus is really on the early years. And, you know, formal school around the world tends to start around grade 1 or 6 years of age. But we know from developmental cognitive neuroscience that kids start learning from birth. And as we just said, you know, babies are born already with some understanding of quantity. And so those early years, kids are doing tons of learning. And it's interesting, too, actually, in Canada, we're talking right now about the need for high-quality early childhood care. But there's almost this false dichotomy when we talk about early learning, where it's talked about childcare and learning as though they're separate.
Okay.
But that's all kids are doing from birth, is everything they're doing is learning. They learn through play. They learn by watching their parents. They learn. They're always learning. And so this idea that we don't really need to learn math until we're in school, I think, is wrong. And really, a lot of what kids are doing before they start school shapes how they think mathematically.
Oh, okay. Now, I know in your work you talk a lot about number symbols, you know, written numbers or displayed numbers in some way, maybe even spoken. Can you tell us what are they and why are they important to study?
So kids have to learn to link the number words to the quantities they represent. So young kids can usually recite the count sequence like a song or a nursery rhyme. A kid might be able to count up to 20 or even 100, but again, back to the sharing idea, if you say, can you give me five things, they haven't yet learned how to use counting to produce sets, or they haven't learned that five refers to exactly five things and that all sets of five are five. And numbers abstract too, right? So five dump trucks look nothing like five Cheerios. Mm-hmm. And so that learning seems to take longer than for kids to learn other properties such as shape and color.
Yeah, okay.
And so this learning takes a really long time, and it's only really by the time kids are about 4 years old that they've learned the cardinality principle. And this is a particularly important milestone in early number learning. This is the knowledge that the last word you use when counting a set of objects denotes the quantity of the set.
Oh, that's like, that's so, we take that such for granted. We forget that you have to learn that.
Exactly.
So how do kids mess it up?
So there's different counting principles. So one-to-one correspondence is one way they might mess it up. So say I'm trying to count these things. If I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and I'm not, if I'm using two number words per object I'm pointing to, for example.
Right.
I might say there's six, because that's six is the last word I use, but I haven't put one word per object. Kids also can confuse, they might skip an object. So there's some executive function demands too. If you line things up for them and show them to go from left to right, for example, as a strategy, they might do better than trying to track all of the things they're trying to count if they're more spatially segregated.
Yeah, I mean, adults are like that too, probably for very large
sets.
It's hard
to
count the number of Cheerios on the floor, right?
Exactly.
All right. So your kids are always learning. Yes, of course. They're always learning. That's, you know, when they're playing, they're just learning little machines. But, you know, you think math learning should be happening in addition to school. And you talk about early exposure to math. So what does it mean to be exposed to math early on?
So through things you do around the house, like counting socks when folding laundry or singing songs that involve counting, like Five Little Monkeys is a favorite of my kid, for example. These are all early experiences with number that support math learning. And so children's cognitive development is influenced by these early experiences they have, and they interact with the brain structure and function. And so, for example, there are regions in the brain dedicated to processing specific types of visual stimuli, such as faces, and these regions become increasingly specialized as children see more faces over their lifespan. Mm-hmm. And the same happens with reading and math. So learning those symbols and exposure to those symbols helps kids to recognize them and refines the brain circuits associated with processing them.
Yeah, I read that learning to read actually uses the face recognition part of the brain. It, like, the people who are illiterate are better at facial recognition because there's like no free lunch.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah, so this is the neuronal recycling hypothesis idea, is that we don't have brain regions that were evolutionarily dedicated to letters and numbers, and so they have to recycle other parts of the brain.
Okay. All right, let's talk about actually doing math. In your work, you stress the importance of executive function, which is sort of your conscious control of what the rest of your mind is doing. Why don't you tell us a bit more about that, and how does that relate to math in kids?
So executive functions are the cognitive skills that help people to focus, manage our emotions, and control behavior. And so they're related to learning and academic achievement across the lifespan. They develop over time and are shaped by cultural and environmental factors. And actually, like, spending time in school is one good way that helps develop executive functions, because these are skills that help us to succeed in school. You know, sitting still, listening to the teacher, following instructions. And so these include abilities like working memory, which involves holding and using information in mind. So you can see how that would be related to doing arithmetic, for example. If you're, say, doing addition and you have to carry over to the decades, right? Carry a one, that's using your working memory. And so we know we need executive functions to do math, as you say. And what I'm interested in as well is, does having strong executive function help with learning math, or like acquiring the meaning of number symbols early in childhood? Mm. And so does having stronger executive function help better prepare children for school? But the research on this and the causal directions is really mixed. And so studies that have tried to train executive functions, for example, show that improving executive function doesn't automatically lead to better skills like math.
But why don't you explain a bit what you mean by the causal direction isn't understood? What are the possibilities?
So it could be that if you have stronger working memory to start, you're better able to learn math. Mm-hmm. Or it could be that actually learning math and acquiring these more advanced skills can actually strengthen your working memory. Because, again, you're using working memory when doing math, and so it might just be practicing your working memory. And actually, one of our studies shows that there is this reciprocal relationship where early executive functions predict later math, but earlier number knowledge is also related to later executive function. So we think these skills build on each other over development.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about math anxiety. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have been or known people who have been anxious about math. What do science know about math anxiety?
So my research is mostly focused on really young kids, age 3 to 6, and I don't see a lot of math anxiety in kids this young. And so I think it really is something that people seem to acquire through bad experiences in school, although this is not my area of research. But my colleague Erin Maloney down the road at University of Ottawa has done lots of research showing, too, that actually how parents and teachers feel about math or their attitudes towards math can influence their students' performance. So parents that have high math anxiety themselves, if they help their kids with homework, their kids tend to do worse than if the parents hadn't helped them at all. And I think this is also why math is important, because I think there's a societal, cultural thing where, you know, we all need to learn to read, and we accept that, but we think math is only for math people. And people feel readily able to admit, like, you know, I'm just not a math person, and they almost give up. And people that feel anxious about math avoid math, and it's this vicious cycle where if you are avoiding math, then of course you're not learning more math. And paradoxically, if we look earlier, it seems to be that kids who acquire more math skills and feel more confident in their math abilities are then more likely to learn more. So we have these feedback loops between how you feel about math and how you do at math that build on each other. And so I think it's important to set kids up early on with strong confidence in their ability to learn math.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed, like, there's more of a stigma with if you say, I don't like to read, then I don't like math, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh, I'm let off the hook because I just don't like math. I'm not good at it, so I never need to worry about it again. But of course, everyone has to be able to read
to
function in this world.
And I'd argue everyone has to be able to do math too, right? But we just, it's not as cool to do math too. Actually, when I've talked about this in class, people brought up the example of the Mean Girls movie where Lindsay Lohan's character actually is really good at math, but pretends to be bad at math because she has a crush on a boy. And it's not cool to be good at math.
Oh, boy.
So there's all kinds of weird social things. And gender things, too. Actually, stereotypes about gender differences in math are still persistent, although there's lots of evidence from cognitive science and neuroscience that boys and girls have very similar basic mathematical abilities. Mm-hmm, there don't seem to be any biological differences.
Right. All right. So we talked a bit about non-curricular math learning. Let's turn to education. Why is math education important?
Well, for exactly the reasons we were just talking about, math has to be explicitly taught. Kids pick up on language like sponges, but they have to be taught the alphabet to learn to read in the same way that kids have to be taught math symbols. And we need to be both literate and numerate to participate in modern society. But if we're looking around the world right now, especially in lower middle income countries, there's a statistic from the World Bank that 70% of kids are not acquiring the proficiency we would expect them to in both literacy and math by the age of 10. And I think this is a lot due to the COVID pandemic and school closures. You know, kids have missed out on years of school, and so now they haven't acquired these skills. But the governments tend to be really reactionary to this. And, you know, by the time kids are 10, they should have spent several years already learning math, and it's a bit late to kind of change it. I mean, you can, but really, if kids were taught earlier, I think then we wouldn't get to that point, right? So early intervention, if we could give kids the skills they need to succeed early on, then by the time they reach 10, they should be better prepared to go on in math.
Yeah, just bathe them in math for their whole childhood, yeah.
And we think of math as something you learn later, to the point that the Quebec Minister of Education last year infamously said that we don't need trained teachers in kindergarten, it's just nap time and babysitting. But really, these are really important years to be teaching kids about math.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, now, when it is taught, how is math typically taught, and what could be some ways that we should improve it?
So, again, thinking about the early years, because of this idea that formal math shouldn't be taught that early and kids should be playing, there's this false dichotomy between direct instruction and free play, right? There's a lot of arguing in the early childhood education space whether kids should just be left to play and explore because that is how kids learn, or whether they should be directly taught things. And again, things like the alphabet and number symbols, they do need to be explicitly taught.
That's not controversial, though, is it?
It is somewhat controversial.
People think that kids will learn the alphabet by just playing by themselves?
Not exactly, but it's there's sort of a debate about when they should be taught, right?
Okay.
Or whether it should be in the early years or whether kids should just be playing.
Oh, okay. I guess that relates to like this general thought that we don't let kids have enough free time and
exactly.
Play. So it's not a brain dead.
No,
position.
And I would never want to sit here and say we have to be drilling multiplication facts into 3-year-olds. That's not my point either. But I think there's lots of ways you can encourage math learning through play. And so guided play is a compromise between direct instruction and exploratory free play. And so it involves providing structured activities that allow learning opportunities for learning and exploration, but also adults would that still guide students towards the relevant content, so math content in this case.
Right. And how about parents? How can parents support math and numeracy at home?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on this as a parent, actually, because parents are tired. And I did listen to your episode with Jody Paluski about mommy brain and the the parental load. And so...
Did it hit home?
It did. And she talked a lot about intensive parenting. And, you know, the American Surgeon General recently released this report about parents' mental health and how it's detrimental to kids' development. And I was listening to a podcast about that, too. And I just had this, like, stinking feeling in my stomach, like, oh, no, this is child development research's fault, isn't it? And it kind of is. We spend so much time saying you need to support kids' early learning through all the things I've just said that parents just feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And so I want to caveat this by saying there's lots of things parents can do, but I also don't want to load on parents saying there's, you know, you have to buy lots of resources or learn new things. It really is, I think, about trying to draw attention to math and the things you're already doing.
Like, yeah, there's so much pressure
baking
on
parents. Yeah.
Right? So like in the things that you're doing already with your kids.
Exactly.
Map it up kind of thing.
Exactly. So, you know, you're baking cookies, you're measuring, you can point out the different quantities with their kids. There's lots of great books and songs with numbers. Actually, even my kid was with her grandpa yesterday, and they played board games, and my dad then was like, she's learning to count. So, you know, people can notice that playing board games, for example, is one really good way to practice counting, like Snakes and Ladders, for example, Candyland. The card game War is basically comparing quantities.
Oh, I never thought that's such an idiot game for an adult. I forget that it's actually got, you know, which number's bigger.
Exactly, and it has. Most playing cards have the symbols, right? The digits and also non-symbolic quantities, like sets of three hearts and or two diamonds.
Oh, that's great. All right. Gave some more credit to the War game.
But so there is, I do think research in my field has kind of put pressure on parents in some ways. And a lot of the existing efforts to promote family engagement have really focused on parent behavior, but paid less attention to like macro system, what we'd call it in Bronfenbrenner's model, sort of more like the cultural sociopolitical factors that influence parents. And so that's why in some of my recent work, for example, if parents don't have time to do these things, then it's not fair to expect parents to do it.
Yeah.
That's why things like parental leave are really important, or, you know, supporting parents to do this kind of engagement with their kids. And more research is needed to understand sort of culturally specific behaviors and values that support early learning in more diverse families.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. You've done some work on different cultures in math. How does culture affect math learning?
Yeah, so one of my recent projects was in South Africa. And one way culture affects math learning is language, the language in which you're learning math. And in South Africa, they actually have 11 official languages.
Wow.
So the language of instruction is often English, but kids have learned to count in their mother tongue. And so there's kind of a misalignment sometimes in the language they're learning at school and the language at home, which has been recognized, and mother tongue lessons are increasingly common. But generally, curricula around the world tend to be adapted from places like the U.S. and the U.K., and we're seeing this misalignment with the kinds of knowledge kids are coming to school with and what the curriculum expects them, where the curriculum expects them to be at. So even the cardinality principle, for example, in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., most kids by age 4 have learned that, but kids in other countries who aren't exposed to high-quality early learning might not already have that mastered by the time they start kindergarten. And there's also different family dynamics and values. So in our research, we were looking at executive functions in South Africa. And while we found that kids in our study who were not attending early education did not have necessarily strong math skills, they did have strong executive functions. And one thing we found that was related to having strong executive functions is having a diversity of caregivers.
Oh.
And this also relates to the parent thing in how, you know, in many cultures and traditions, parents are not expected to do it alone. They have aunts and uncles and grandparents and older siblings and community members who all help care for their kids. And so in our study, we found that certain aspects of these more collectivist cultures are actually a strength, It might promote stronger executive functions. So having multi-generational households that are more common in other countries might be protective. And even in interviews with parents, caregivers said that having that social support from their family and community was important for their own mental health and then supporting the development of their child.
Yeah, and you know that brings us back to COVID, where a lot of kids were just stuck with only their parents for a couple of years, you know, and they lack maybe their executive function was impaired slightly by that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the parent of a young child, Marin. I've met Marin. Has watching her given you any insights or ideas about math, or made anything more vivid for you?
The biggest surprise for me, honestly, was learning that having done a PhD in cognitive development didn't really prepare me for being a parent.
Oh, you were surprised by that.
I mean, it's not like I thought I'd have it all figured out, but I think in much the same way as it's challenging to apply the findings from research to math classrooms, that studying how kids learn and develop doesn't directly lead into insights into how to use this information in practice.
Wow. It's like reading how to swim kind of thing.
Yeah. And as a cognitive scientist, I was never very interested in babies.
Right.
I think partly because I underestimated their cognitive abilities, to be honest. That was one thing that surprised me watching my own kid learn is babies are amazing.
Okay.
But they can't talk. And so when you're trying to understand how they think as researchers, you rely on looking time or pointing and you have to make a lot of inferences.
But now that you're seeing it, you can see, wow, there's something going on in there, even though they can't talk yet.
Yeah. And also, it's hard to get good data. I volunteered in a baby lab when I was a grad student. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, we'd have a baby scheduled, and the parent would cancel at the last minute because the baby fell asleep. Right. Now, as a parent, I understand. You don't mess with babies' nap schedules. But as a graduate student, that was frustrating.
You're like, wake him up.
Yeah. Or then babies that did show up would fuss out. So they start crying or just stop paying attention halfway through the study.
Oh, my God.
But watching, like being able to watch kids learn as a parent has been really interesting. And we rely a lot on cross-sectional data in cognitive development research too. And so you get this like snapshot of kids thinking at one point in time. And researchers know this, but again, watching my own kid, it's development's not linear.
Right.
Kids are always exploring and trying new strategies. So even if they succeed on a task at one point, at one day, they might not the next. And they're just kind of continuously trying new things and learning and changing. But I've been doing a diary study of my kid's use of number words and just writing down how she uses different number words.
Did you have to get ethics for that?
No, don't tell her dad. actually, I did tell her dad at one point because I'm modeling after another researcher. Kelly Mix did a diary study. There's a paper called How Spencer Made Number. And she says in the paper that the kid's dad was blind to the study. But at one point, I kept asking my husband to sort of take videos of me doing number stuff with my kid or other things. So finally, I told him, I was like, look, I'm doing this study. I didn't want to tell you because I didn't want to bias you. And his response was just, well, the fact that you are a neuroscientist raising this child is already biasing this study more than I possibly could. But that's been surprising, too, actually, to see her dad and other adults in her life being surprised that she can't count, for example. So again, the example of sharing, you know, people don't realize that kids don't have that knowledge. And so sometimes they'll be like, come on, you don't have three, you have four. Or, correcting her.
Right, a little impatient or something like that. Wow, that's great.
She was in childcare in French fully from the time she was about a year old to 2.5. And so I thought maybe she'd be learning numbers in French, but she really wasn't at all, which was surprising to me. She could recite the count sequence to 6 in French, but she wouldn't really do any of our tasks in French, which I guess, from 1 to 2, you don't expect a ton of math instruction at school, but I think this further supports that that's not what they're doing in childcare typically, right?
Right.
I don't think she'd really got any explicit instruction on math.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. This is Dr. Rebecca Merkley. How can people find out more about your work if they care to?
Well, our biggest project recently is called the AIM Collective. It's Assessment and Instruction for Mathematics. So if you go to aimcollective.ca, you'll find stuff about that. And this is work in partnership with schools across Canada trying to use research for math cognition to improve assessment and instruction strategies in schools.
That's wonderful. So check that out. And thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks, Jim.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and The Doppler Effect for making Jim's voice sound even higher when you're walking toward your speakers. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a rating or review in your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. If you want to connect with Minding the Brain on social media, you can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.